What about the zucchini? Did you for sure taste zucchini?
That was the first thing that shot into my mouth.
Sentence I never thought I'd hear anyone say, but here we are.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 297 for the week of April 6th, 2020. I am Meal Cannon Submission, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Silver Dollar Pancake, Sarah D. Bunting.
Check, please.
Sawed-off Shotgun, Tara Ariano.
Chunk, kaboom!
And Anonymous Business Card, Adam Sternberg.
Know any terminal patients who need money? Just asking.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for this week. Joining us, our dear friend Adam Sternberg. Hello, Adam.
Yay!
Adam, we're here to talk about something, I'm going to just say it, very dumb.
I've been looking forward to this for a while, actually.
The launch of the new streaming video platform, Quibi. Now, a few weeks ago when we had Margaret on, we had a game time that was Quibi-inspired, where the premise was, which of these are real Quibi shows? Which of them are fake? Surprisingly challenging game at the time. Now, of course, we would all ace it. What is Quibi? Quibi is a new video streaming platform. It's only for mobile devices. And the idea is there is no piece of content longer than 10 minutes. Most of them are in the 6 to 7 minute range. And that's it. Like, it's launching at the dumbest time for such a thing to happen. I mean, it's co-founded by Meg Whitman, formerly of Hewlett-Packard, Jeffrey Katzenberg, formerly of DreamWorks. Also on staff is Mr. Reese Witherspoon, Jim Toth, who is the director of acquisitions. He's an agent. And yet they're launching this mobile video streaming service at a time when we're not supposed to be mobile, and yet this is happening, this video platform that you actually, I believe, cannot stream to your TV even if you want to. So we each picked two shows from the 24 titles the platform's launching with. We will report back on them momentarily, but before we drill down, let's talk a bit generally about this platform, because it's definitely not for me. I work from home. I don't commute. I subscribe to all the big streaming services. I watch them on my TV like an adult. I don't think I've ever watched a video longer than about 3 minutes on my phone. Adam, your life, at least under normal circumstances, is different from mine. Is this platform, at least in concept, leaving aside the actual programming, is it for you?
Huh. You know, I don't know that I fully resolved that question. The awesome thing about Quibi is I think that when everyone first heard about it, up in the months and months of anticipation, there was this vague sense of like, is this actually a real thing?
Right.
Is this actually going to be in the world? And like a lot of people, and it also seemed like it would either turn out to be sort of the thing that's remembered in history books as the kind of sound of peak TV bubble popping was the launch of this thing. Yet at the same time, I have to admit that when I was downloading the app and I was watching the shows, there was a little part of me that was like, I think there is room in my life for a little 8 minute hit of some weird random TV show. Now, whether the TV shows on offer are weird enough and random enough and different enough from the sort of weird random things that you can find pretty easily on the internet is, I think, a kind of existential question for Quibi right now. But for example, last night after my kid had gone to bed and it had obviously been sort of a long day, I suddenly was like, oh, I could watch a Quibi right now. And it filled me with a tiny Quibi-sized amount of joy. So I'm not going to write it off quite yet.
But when you say, you watch Quibi in the same way that you might watch something on YouTube, they're very different pieces of content. A Quibi is, which stands for Quick Bite. Is that what we're going with?
Okay. Yes.
So a Quibi, which I hate defining Quibi as a unit of measurement. Yeah. It really bothers me. But a Quibi is...
it's like a flues. Remember that?
Flues and beans. Yeah.
Oh,
boy. So a Quibi is like a repurposed traditional piece of television content, whereas something on YouTube that would be the same length is like some guy jumping on chairs in his backyard or some usually non-professional piece of content that people are enjoying because it's non-professional. Like, I, at the end of the day, I think Quibi's legacy is going to be a really good, what the fuck were they thinking article in like some magazine.
Right.
All the disastrous thinking that went into it, because mm-hmm. they just don't understand who this is for in a way that's actually going to have enough asses in the seats for them to actually sustain the model.
I mean, I just was going to break in and say, I think YouTube is trying to grow up into more of like a professional platform in
They've
the Hulu.
Tried and failed three different times.
I know, but I'd say I think TikTok is more what you're describing of like people doing goofy shit online for free.
Sure, in that weird little format, but that stuff happened. I mean, YouTube is where it started, right? I mean,
you're right. Continue.
Whatever the platform is.
Fair enough.
Vine, TikTok.
Okay, yeah,
like, these are all things that are the same.
Okay.
This isn't new. This isn't even new with like the same people, like Spielberg and Katzenberg. Is that who's involved in this one? Mm-hmm. Do you remember pop.com?
Yeah.
Like, it was the same mm-hmm. idea, just without so many technical hooks into cell phones, obviously, because it was right. like way back when. But it was the same thing. Short animated stuff, like just bite-sized content, and it like disappeared. This is not a new idea. I guess they just think that the time is right now. Mm-hmm. And I think actually, obviously it is, because TikTok et al. But I don't think it's going to work with the content that they're delivering.
Yeah.
One, because I think people have that everywhere else. And just the fact that it's shorter doesn't really matter, especially when so much of the content on Quibi is obviously something longer that's been chopped up into just smaller pieces, which is one problem. Mm-hmm. But it's just like a very different animal as far as like what you're going into it for.
And yet it's not different enough. Like,
yeah.
I mean, there is a place in my life if I'm like, I don't know, fixing lunch and then eating it, like the fixing it takes as long as the eating it. I eat really fast. So it's like, is there room for an 8-minute episode in my life, even though I share a similar work lifestyle to Tara? Yes, there is. But if you're gonna, like, I have long felt like our culture generally doesn't have enough room for like things that don't fit into like a car that doesn't fit on the road we already built, like short stories. Who asks for those anymore? Short films. Who watches those outside of Oscars completists? Like, I feel like we as a culture should make more room for little things that are shaped differently. But like Dave said, like, this is just like, it's not thinking about storytelling in any kind of different way. Mostly it's just like, writing to the check of how short it is. And like, one of the shows that I watched for this discussion is clearly a half hour show that they just chopped into. They just put two joints in it and then cut it into three pieces mm-hmm. for three episodes. Like, well, then just make that for HGTV. Oh, that's right. This idea is tacky and not interesting. So they didn't want it.
Right. Well, we'd also be remiss if we didn't talk about the fuckery. And there's more to come with both one of the shows that Adam picked. But while this hasn't really been investigated in a reported piece that I have seen so far, and I looked this morning, apparently one of the features of Quibi behind the scenes is that the length of the content pieces that are being produced means they don't fall under established entertainment union contracts. Our old TWAP forum poster, Kyle, remember Kyle, Dave? K-I-S-L-E.
Yeah.
He pointed me to a tweet from the actor Griffin Newman from The Tick, who was actually on Joe's podcast this week. Shout out, Joe. And he was quote tweeting someone at Van the Brand on Twitter, was saying that only the Teamsters are getting paid their full rate. Someone in the replies is an editor who said that because the Quibi content is under 18 minutes, it wouldn't be eligible for Editors Guild protection. So this seems bad. Like, Christoph Waltz is probably not taking a pay cut to be in his shitty thing, but a lot of people who don't have powerful agents presumably did. Yeah. I mean, just, you know, the fact that so much of this is reality seems like this is probably going to be the long-term plan for this platform of, like, we're going to do things on the cheap as despite the big splashes of, you know, announcements, but this is just going to be a way to pay people less.
To break unions.
Yeah.
And other things are not, like, I mean, I guess we should start discussing the content, but, like, some of these ideas are, like, snakes on a planey in that it's like,
right.
This is a fun idea. I don't need to see it spun out to its logical conclusion. I need 7 minutes.
All right. Well, since we've already alluded to it, let's start with Sarah. why don't you tell us about Murder House Flip?
It's a half-hour HGTV show about flipping murder houses. Mm-hmm. But basically, the design team comes in, meets the homeowners of a property on which Murder Most Foul occurred in the premiere. It is a Sacramento home in which a little old lady in a previous century poisoned like myriad victims with creme de menthe. Like, just another reason not to drink creme de menthe. It's vile. But then, like, they have this sort of hoarded side yard, and then the woman, the wife and the couple is a mosaic crafter. So all this is happening, but it's like the most boring, fillery, suspenseless parts of both true crime and like flip shows on HGTV. Like, you have no sense of how long things take to do.
Yeah.
You have, like, the murder house part of it is like, and here are these cutesy chyrons that look like blueprints, but involving someone killing people. Like, what the fuck are we doing here? Yeah. My writing partner on the Best Evidence newsletter, Eve Beatty, was crestfallen that she did not receive screeners of Murder House Flip. And I am here to assure her and all the rest of you that this is a skip.
Ooh,
bad.
We watched those episodes as you did. And after the first one was done, I turned to Tara and said, look, I don't want to make it out that I'm super stupid, but was that real or just a really bad comedic take on this concept? Because I honestly couldn't really tell. Not that it was like doing a good job of walking the line. It was just like, it was stupid enough to be real or unreal. And like the old couple, like, they were goofy enough that it seemed like they were just, local actors really happy to finally be on TV.
Yeah.
And I just like, I just couldn't tell if this was actually happening somewhere in the real world. Apparently it is, but that just speaks to how dull the actual circumstances, or at least the way they were presented, you know, like, on his face, sweet old lady poisons half a dozen or more people and buries them all in this tiny little yard. It's kind of a neat story to go through. But in this context, it was super boring.
Until they put a fire pit, like, guys. Yeah.
And then they bring these people, the flippers in, and like, it's almost like these people weren't told exactly the full concept of the show, because they're like, really seemed like back of a napkin to show in about 3 days, and it really showed.
And the one designer was like, he looked like he wanted to leave. Mikkel.
Yeah.
He's like, all of those shows are contrived, and then the timelines are jammed up in a way that, like, this is why I don't care for those shows, because I have no idea how long things really took to do. And they're like, not processy enough for me most of the time. And this was that, but then also that, like, glib sort of informationless, handle-free filler of a true crime show that's like, you know, previously on Murder House Flip, like, we seriously just saw this and you only have 7 minutes. Why?
I am not a crackpot, but in these shows, why are we still, as a society, putting up with these artificial deadlines? Like, we only have a day and a half to, like, if you're on the other end of that, you're like, you know what? I'm going to pass. I'm going to actually save up and get somebody real who's going to take a week and a half to do this renovation, because you know what's not going to happen? Yeah. Quality workmanship.
Right.
I'm not crackpot.
Mm-hmm. No, you're not.
I will say, of all the, when they started announcing the different shows months ago, there was a sort of common joke bouncing around that, like, so many of the Quibi shows sounded like fake shows from 30 Rock.
Yep.
And this was the number one example. Exhibit A was Murder House Flip. So I'm disappointed to hear. But I sort of suspect that I don't know if impressed is the word, but I have to say there's a surprising amount of content available on Quibi from day one. And I have a suspicion that certain shows are literally just to get people to pay attention to Quibi. And I feel like Murder House Flip is one of them. It's like a log line that's sort of irresistible. And eventually it will kind of like disappear and they'll find whatever their the Sopranos of Quibi will be. But yeah. In the meantime, I feel like there's a lot of spaghetti being thrown at the wall here.
Yeah.
Literally, yeah.
Oh, well, that's a good segue. Let's go to Dave next. Dave, why don't you tell us about Dishmantle?
Yeah, Dishmantle is my favorite of all the shows that we watched. It is, I always get his last name wrong, Burgess. Mm-hmm. And the premise of the show is they have these cannons and they put two people that are chefs in the real world in sort of like hazmat suits. And then they shoot a dish at them. And it explodes on them, and they have, they're blindfolded, and they have to sort of taste the food that's just been exploded on them, and then strip out of their hazmat suit, go into the kitchen, and try to create the dish that was just shot at them.
Yep.
And the whole episode lasts 6 minutes, and, you know, they deliver the dish, and there's a chef judge, there's a celebrity judge, and Titus, and whoever use the most ingredients in common with the dish wins, and that's it. And yep. It's 6 minutes long. It's like the perfect length for this show. It was actually kind of hard because what we did is we watched this, and then later that same night, we went back and continued, nailed it.
I was just going to say.
And much like I said a few months ago
on a Patreon
thing, where we were talking about shows that have the wrong time length, nailed it should be, you know, 8 minutes long, not 30 minutes long. And this show really just brought that home.
Yep.
But it is really fun and dumb. Like, do I need to see three more seasons of Dismantle? No. And that's one of the problems with all these Quibi shows is they're so high concept that like you only get so much out of it.
Right.
And then you're like, I've seen it. I'm done. What's next?
Yep.
But it was the least shovel-wary show that I think I watched. Mm-hmm. And it was just dumb fun.
We're only going to cover 8 shows here. I wrote up all of them and I ranked them for Primetimer, so we'll link that in the show notes. But I described this one as the most Black Mirror premise of all shows. And I stand by that, and yet it works, and I stand by that too. It's very entertaining.
There's something akin to this show in the way that those sites are like, we just got a really new expensive piece of technology. Can we put it in a blender? Like, it has that sort of wastefulness quality to it that you're like, you know, I feel like the show, like, is one of those shows where if it was on a bigger network, there would have been pressure at the end to have like an end scene where they're shown like donating 10 crates of food to Second Harvest or something like that. But it's good. It's fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to go to the, I'll go next and I'll go at the opposite end of the spectrum with I Promise, which is a documentary series about the I Promise school that LeBron James established in Akron, Ohio, his hometown. So it shows in, again, very short segments that feel like they were cut up from probably a feature length documentary, how the school was founded and sort of the holistic approach to education that was taken, you know, in conceiving how it was going to work. There's clearly kind of a strong social work foundation to it. They take into account all of the reasons that a child might be at risk, and they started with specifically only enrolling children in Akron who are considered to be at risk. And so with that in mind, like, there's a food bank on site. Kids get meals on site, all of their meals. The school day is 9 to 5, like, to take into account parents might not have, you know, aftercare for their kids. But at the same time, it also, you know, covers the kind of trauma that makes children, you know, be in the at-risk class in the first place. Like, you know, one girl is living with her grandparents. Her grandmother has passed away, and her father has been in and out of prison. And he, like, straight up says, I just talk to her like she's an adult, and she's in grade 3. Like, not appropriate. Another kid is one of 9 kids of his single mother who works 6 days a week and, you know, was on site when his uncle's house was raided by the SWAT team. And, you know, they have behavioral issues as a result of that. And so the teachers have to kind of go behind what is, you know, the cause of behavioral issues that will pull them out of the classroom and then puts them behind because, you know, teachers at regular schools that don't take this into account will just pull them out instead of trying to understand what it is that they're doing and why, you know. And then it also talks, you know, and it deals with the teachers and the educators that are on site and the trauma that they experience having to deal with this and like the stress of having to, you know, have deal with this, all of this emotion that's coming at them all the time. So does it make sense for this format? Absolutely not. It does. As I said, it feels like a frontline that got cut into bits so that I would be more likely to watch it 8 minutes at a time rather than feel like it's, you know, a huge commitment to watch, you know, an hour or 90 minutes of it, which, okay, fine. And it also feels like a prestige play from Quibi to confer some gravitas on what is obviously otherwise an extremely disposable enterprise. But it is still absolutely a story worth telling. I want to see the whole thing, but I won't until someone edits it all together and puts it on a real service. Like, sorry. I mean, that's the truth.
I'm kind of wondering, like, after you watch the episode, I haven't gone to the actual Quibi app because we got screeners, but I just imagine, like, next up, you know, when it just scrolls on to the next show, so you just watched I Promise. Now try Punked with Chance the Rapper.
Exactly. Yeah, there is another documentary called Run This City that is about, like, the guy who was the youngest mayor ever elected in this town in Massachusetts, who then, like, immediately got into huge amounts of trouble with corruption charges.
That was Parks and Recreation.
No. Which was not as interesting to me. But anyway, I Promise is great. But like I said, you know, there's no reason. Like, make it a real movie and I'll watch it. I'm not going to watch it like this. Sorry. Did it make me cry? Yes. Let's move on to Adam. Why don't you start with Memory Hole?
I will start with Memory Hole. So the two shows that I selected to watch were Memory Hole and Most Dangerous Game. And I made those selections based on not whether I think things will be good or bad, but whether they're going to be for me or not for me. And Memory Hole I chose because it is pitched oddly as a kind of pop culture talk soup style show in which Will Arnett dissects mostly obscure Canadian pop culture, which seemed too improbable to be true. So I decided to watch it. I also thought it would be appropriate because I feel like one day, ironically, Memory Hole might be a title for a show that describes the entire Quibi experience for people. This show is so odd. It's both extraordinarily familiar in that I could describe it to you as it's talk soup for obscure Canadian pop culture, and then you basically get the whole thing. It's Will Arnett in front of a green screen spending 8 minutes talking about things which are familiar to me because I grew up in Canada, but which I cannot imagine have any resonance to a lot of people in the world, things like the TV show Beachcombers or the TV show The Littlest Hobo or Alan Thicke. It's a really strange experience. And as I watched it, I know it's also co-created by this Canadian comedy writer named Scott Vroman. And as I was watching it, the words that kept going through my head were tax credits.
Yeah.
Because I have to imagine this was like a highly subsidized enterprise. It also looks like it cost about $40 to do the whole thing. The most fun thing is watching, like, I watched three episodes in a row and thinking about Will Arnett after each one having to go and change into a new outfit to pretend that he didn't knock this entire thing off in 2 hours in one day.
At least he bothered. Not like some people. At least.
I mean, did I find it mildly amusing to listen to Will Arnett make sort of half-baked cracks about Alan Thicke performing at the Sky Dome opening ceremony in the 1980s? Sort of. But I also kept thinking, like, if this show is like, this show couldn't be more for me because I remember watching Alan Thicke on the Sky Dome opening ceremony when it was on before. And I only found it mildly amusing, and I have to confess, in the first episode, I kept track of where I paused to see how much time was left, and it was 2 minutes into a 4-minute episode.
Oh, no.
I mean, I do feel like if you're going to do the talk soup thing, it has to be like every joke has to hit, and the subject matter has to be sort of worthy of that kind of extended ridicule. And watching Will Arnett sort of make jokes about The Littlest Hobo, it was very, very both surreal, but not surreal enough. Which kind of brings us to the other point, which I didn't know until I saw someone talking about it on Twitter.
I didn't either.
But this show, like, pretty brazenly mirrors an existing internet property called, coincidentally, Memory Hole,
yeah.
which is put together by this art collective called Everything is Terrible, where they basically put together these YouTube videos that are like 2 or 3 minutes long that are like themed found footage videos.
Mm-hmm.
If you are interested in a little like quick hit of sort of pleasing surreality, Google Memory Hole Clown Town. Go watch their episode, which has a bunch of found footage that revolves around clowns. But I think the juxtaposition between those two things, besides the fact that this Memory Hole seems like they pretty brazenly ripped the other one off,
yeah.
Demonstrates the sort of odd problem with like the Quibi concept in general, which is like there are little digestible bits of things like this already in the universe, and they tend to be sort of more funny and weirder
yeah.
than what Memory Hole is able to do or trying to do. And in mm-hmm. fact, I'm pretty sure that I've already watched a YouTube video that kind of where like a dude in Canada just went through the Sky Dome opening ceremony and made fun of it, and it was quite funny. So I watched my 3 mandated episodes of Memory Hole. I have to say the first one has already gone down my personal memory hole. I remember most of it was talking about like examples of sports teams rapping and kind yeah. of making yeah. fun of like the Chicago Bears, which again, you're just like, why in 2020? Why am I watching Will Arnett do this?
Can I tell you my take home from that episode and the only thing I remember? And I can do it like using dialogue that happened in our living room. Oh shit, it's Lanny McDonald. That was it. Like that mustache, that guy. I had that guy's hockey card when mm-hmm. he was playing for the Maple
oh,
Leafs.
Oh, totally.
Like, oh shit. There he is. That was it. And yeah, the rest of it out of my head.
Oh, and yes, that's right. And he sings a song. It's so I don't know if you have like an 8 minute sized hole in your life where you need like a talk soup for obscure Canadian pop culture, then please have at it. But I myself will not be revisiting Memory Hole. I did not follow it on my Quibi app, and I won't be watching any further episodes.
It was forgettable, but I think in the future it will be just an important milestone on the sort of heat death of the universe inevitability of Will Arnett hosting every TV show there
really,
is.
It's a bummer.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go back to Sarah. Sarah, tell us about Chrissy's Court.
There was really not much to tell. And this is, I think, the best realized use of the concept of the stuff that I watched. We'll get back to the dark underbelly of that comment when we get back to Adam mm-hmm. and his other entry. Grr. Chrissy's Court is basically the People's Court, but in 7 minutes with Chrissy Teigen as the judge, and her mom is the bailiff. That part of the show and like the mom trying on pieces of evidence is not as funny as it thinks it is, but it also like doesn't dwell on that because it can't because it's 7 minutes long. You know, she marches in to court wearing like different wigs and different, like, you know, Judge Judy has her little collars over the robe.
Mm-hmm.
Teigen has these like huge statement necklaces on, or like Birkenstocks, like so that's amusing. And then it's a People's Court case, but like everybody seems to be in on the joke. I watched the 3. The first one is a couple that like they had two different versions of a gift, like a Lizzo based gag gift in mind for a friend. The friend appears as a witness via Skype. They are clearly, everyone is on the point of bursting out laughing at all times. It was amusing. And then the third one is this sort of like nothing burger dispute about two friends with benefits and who is supposed to be giving whom a ride in the car that was maybe sold or maybe given to the other person. But the second episode is gold. This lounge singer, Joey, someone is suing the defendant guy for the cost of a speaker because the guy, while Joey, the lounge singer, was performing some Sinatra, this guy comes up and asks if he knows any hip hop songs. And Joey, the lounge singer, was very startled and stumbled back into his speaker and knocked it over and it broke. So now he wants to recoup the cost of the speaker. So expert witness, Kai Ronda's sexiest expert witness alive, John Legend, naturally, comes to judge, like, I don't know, the veracity of Joey's statement. And then there's like a reenactment with them both singing My Way. And then she finds in favor of Joey, the lounge singer, who's like, and this went my way. And he sustains the note for like 30 seconds. Then he's like, single note, single breath, John, like really rudely to John Legend. Like it's
cute.
It's exactly what you expect it to be. Nothing more, nothing less. And it is perfectly matched to Chrissy Teigen and John Legend's like sort of family social media brand.
Yeah.
The whatever AirPods kerfuffle notwithstanding. And at least she walked that back. Not like some people. Mm-hmm. We'll get to it. Mm-hmm. The there's this like bite-sizedness to your interactions with her. Like, do I need to watch a whole hour of a Chrissy Teigen talk show? No. This is perfect. It's fairly funny. Everyone's having a good time. Justice appears to be served. That there's some good jokes. Like, if I had to pay for this, would I pay for it? No. But this was the best of the stuff that I saw. It's cute.
Yeah, it was good. Dave, why don't you go next? Talk about Flipped.
Yeah, so I picked this one just because Will Forte was in it, and I do enjoy some Will Forte humor. I did not enjoy Flipped because it didn't have a lot of humor in it. The concept is two losers are married, and they get into their head that they can be the next HGTV Flip star, you know, because they're throwing another one of those contests where you submit your stuff. And they buy this foreclosure middle of the desert shack. And as they're just poking around, they find that it's actually a cartel money hiding shack. So they take the money and they do this lavish production of their test video. And it just ends with the cartel catching up with them. But like, nothing's really well observed. And it doesn't really poke really good fun at the whole genre. And it just doesn't go anywhere. And it was short. It was obviously cut up from a larger, you know, thing, just like a lot of other stuff. But it just didn't go anywhere. And they couldn't really figure out like where to hang their coat on each episode. It just sort of like hung there until the third episode. It didn't really have a button on anything.
Yeah.
And by that time, you're like, okay, that would have been the first act of the hour long, whatever this would have been, or right, the half hour long thing this would have been.
Yeah.
I was just surprised because it seemed like it was going to be pretty good from all the talent involved. But then once you realize that Quibi is just a dumping ground for everybody's stuff, then, it makes perfect sense why this is what it is, mm-hmm, which is not funny and disappointing.
Yeah. I mean, of the comedies, it's in the upper tier, but that's not saying much. So my next thing, in the spirit of Chrissy's Court and Dishmantle, that's one of the better, I think, comedy concepts that is definitely made for the platform, Game Show with a Y and an exclamation mark. It's a scripted fake game show where two straight male comedians are competing to be queen of the straights. It's hosted by two gay comedians, Dave Mazzoni and Matt Rogers, and then each of the straight contestants gets a lifeline or life partners, as they're called, either a wise gay or a woman who gets it, and they like help them out through the concept or through the segment. So it starts with celebrity essences, where you get three things, and from that you have to triangulate who the person is. The first episode, it's bell bottoms, wax museum, and then a picture of Anne Hathaway that's captioned Arne Jonovan. Matt Rogers goes, "I loved her in The Durbel Wears Purdle." Of course, it's John Travolta. The next segment, they mixed it up in the screeners that we saw. In the first one, it was She's Running, where the two had to have a debate. And the proposed was, should gay people have to stand in line? So whoever goes first has to just take the position, and then the other person has to say the opposite, whether they agree with it or not. Then in the second episode that we saw, it was Notice Me, Father, where the idea is your dad has come to your dance recital, and so you have to impress him. And Matt Rogers plays the dad with like a suit and glasses and a briefcase. The dancers have to like emotionally win him over. Then the third one, it was What Lies Beneath, which is digging for gay artifacts. That was the worst one. And then finally, always the last one is Make an Entrance. Pretty much exactly what it sounds like. All through all of them, they just throw around bonus points for doing incredibly dumb stuff. Like, well, you mentioned Cher, so that's 50 bonus points. Like,
it reminded me of the game show.
Yes, like the talk show the game show. Yes. It's designed for the format. It's fast and dumb. Like, again, like we said about Dishmantled and Nailed It, like this knows what it is. It was made to be 6 minutes long.
Yeah.
It has no stakes. It's funny and fast. It's like you forget it as soon as it's over. But it's, you know, it's charming for as long as it's lasts. And if it was a whole half hour, it would be too much.
Way too much.
But
yeah.
6 minutes is plenty.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was funny.
It was fun. Yeah,
even Dave liked it.
Yeah, it was good. And it felt like the production where the most thought went into the actual production.
Yeah.
Not that they spent a lot of money on it, mm-hmm. but the sets were minimal yet effective. The graphics were really great.
Yeah.
You know, they had the singer that does all the little bumpers from section to section that mm-hmm. worked really well.
Yep.
It was just like really tight. Like it's only 6 minutes long, mm-hmm. But keeping it tight.
Yeah.
And it was effective. I think it was like non-scripted, mm-hmm. one of the strongest marriage of Quibi concept and execution.
I agree. Then there's Adam's other show, Most Dangerous Game. I think all of us watch this, so we all have opinions. Adam, tell us about Most Dangerous a Game.
I'm so curious why everyone watched it. Is it because of the star power of Liam Hemsworth and Christoph Waltz? Or is it the compelling the premise of The Most Dangerous Game, which everyone should know by now because this short story has been adapted into various forms for now 100 years. The original short story was written in the 1920s. It's in the public domain at this point. But the most dangerous game is hunting humans. In this case, on this show, the human is Liam Hemsworth, or as his character is known on the show, Dodge. Get it? And okay, here's what I have to say about Most Dangerous Game, and then everyone else can say what they thought about it. As I mentioned, the reason I chose this as my other show is because it seemed very for me. I like cheesy action movies. I have been known in the past, when I don't have a lot of time, to sit down and watch the movie Six Underground on Netflix in 10-minute chunks, just to be like, Six Underground. and so my mind was open to Most Dangerous Game. And it's a movie about a guy who has terminal cancer, and he gets an ominous business card at the hospital that apparently has been left there by this sinister businessman played by Christoph Waltz, in which he proposes to people who, for one reason or another, have run out of hope that they allow themselves to be hunted by humans for 24 hours, and then they receive some amount of money for every hour that they survive. And if they're killed, the money goes to their family. And so the basic premise of the show is sort of laid out in extraordinarily, shall we say, efficient manner in the first 8-minute episode. I kept thinking that if Breaking Bad had been a Quibi show, the first episode would literally just have opened with Walter White sitting across a desk from Gus Fring, and Gus Fring would be, "So you have cancer?" And he'd be like, "Yes, and I don't know how to pay for my treatment." And he'd be like, "Why don't you cook meth?" And then Walter White would pause and go, "I'm listening," and then that's the end of the first episode, which is basically how Dangerous Game works. It's like a very familiar action movie, like boiled down to its like most essential beats. So there's like in the second episode, which is the sort of backstory episode, there's even a moment where Liam Hemsworth is like flipping through a pile of envelopes that say past due and like overdue bill. And you're like, yeah, you don't need to explain. We've seen movies. We know you guys are poor. All you need to do is flip through a pile of envelopes that say past due. We get it. So, you know, is it good? Hard to say. But would I watch more episodes of The Dangerous Game? I It was the one show that I watched, and I sampled a few of the other ones freely. It was the one show I watched where I was like, I will keep watching this. I will definitely pick up my phone when I have 6 to 8 minutes, and I will find out what's happening on Dangerous Game.
Adam.
Because I like...
I'm begging you to love yourself
movies.
Enough not to watch this show.
Let me ask you this, Adam.
The game hasn't fucking started yet.
Would you watch this story if it wasn't on Quibi, but it was where it was intended to be, which is DirecTV straight to video on demand?
We know he would. Absolutely, he already said not. He watches Six Underground multiple times.
But you would have to make it an effort to find it, and you would have to pay for it.
Dave's point is well taken. I would not watch this movie because it is very, it's not, I mean, Six Underground is bonkers. That's why I like Six Underground.
That's true.
This is not bonkers in any way. It's like the opposite of bonkers. It's like this very, very familiar kind of movie of the week premise doled out. And I have to say, obviously, with the Dangerous Game, like, it's going to live and die, no pun intended, based on how surprising it is once the game starts and the people who come and who betrays him and who's in on the game and all that sort of thing. Like I said, is it good? Aren't we sort of in a post? Isn't Quibi exist in a sort of post good or bad universe?
There's no evidence that the most dangerous game ever starts, frankly. Like,
yeah.
We watched
Thank
a billion
you.
Episodes and the fucking thing has, the game hasn't even started yet.
It's not the most dangerous anything. It's not even a fucking game. It's goddamn Christoph Waltz talking about, like, oh, it's already started. Like, oh, word? Couldn't somebody have woken me up? I'm fucking pissed. This was at the end of 4 episodes, each of which are really pushing the boundaries. They're like 9 or 11 minutes long. So you're really expecting, because it's Quibi, that you're not going to have to sit through this like 20 or 25 minutes of flashback backstory with the like simpy, roomy, weepy wife. Like, whatever. Like, he has a brain tumor and he wants to make money for his family. I don't need the scene with the building of the fucking crib. Get to the game. Less talky, more gamey.
I like that in the Quibi universe, the equivalent of like those Game of Thrones episodes where everyone would be like, I can't believe this episode's an hour and a half, is like a 9-minute episode. You're like, what's with this? It's 11 minutes. What's
Don't
happening?
Don't call it the most dangerous game then. Yeah. Call it an Austrian Oscar winner talks a whole lot about some stuff. And then you bail. Because who has time for this shit?
All right, let's close it up. Quibi is $4.99 a month with ads, $7.99 a month without ads. To put this in context, Hulu without ads is $5.99 a month.
Hold on, where are they putting these ads?
I don't know. Before and after, I assume.
Well, then who gives a fuck?
Who knows?
I'm not finding out.
Yeah, me neither. This is ridiculous. But Adam, it sounds like, is in for it. So.
I'm in for 90 days. I have 88 days left.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from John C., and it is called Should Have Been Filmed in Front of a Live Studio Audience. To wit, John C. writes, what single camera sitcom, current or past, would you most like or have liked to be done or have instead been done as a multicam? I have a couple of ideas. My first is Ally McBeal, sort of on the line. I believe it was submitted in the Emmys as a comedy. I think it counts anyway. It was, you know, last track or not.
Pretty funny.
But yeah, the reason that I would say it should have been a multicam is so that there would have been no sheen of prestige to it. It certainly got a lot of attention as a show that was trying to say something, capital S, capital S, and it wasn't. It was just a dumb show. And if it were a multicam, that would be clear. That is one option. My other option is The Crazy Ones, the short-lived one-season CBS sitcom from a few years ago, starring Robin Williams, among many others. Sarah Michelle Gellar was in the cast as well. R.I.P. And the reason that I would have done that is because it's Robin Williams. Like, if you have the chance to put him in a sitcom, especially one which is like an office sitcom, which is mostly going to be on one set anyway, because it was set at an ad agency, put him in front of a live audience that he can feed off. Maybe it would have made that show feel a lot less inert than it did. Perhaps it would have lasted longer than the one season that it did. And CBS, for all their faults, actually do know how to nurture a multicam sitcom. See the many examples of same.
Mine is very simple and straightforward. I choose New Girl. And the reason is because I think of all the single camera sitcoms, New Girl is the one that at its heart most resembled a multicam sitcom. Mm-hmm. Most of the action took place in one location at the house. It was a very classic sitcom setup. And it was all about just the interaction of the different roommates and the different characters. It wasn't an Arrested Development where there was chopped up plot lines and you had to go and shoot on like 75 different locations to put together a half hour worth of TV. I think just as there are multicam sitcoms from the end of that era that you look back and go, oh, that totally would have worked as a single cam. This one just feels like it was single cam because it happened to come out at the moment when single cam was very much in vogue, which is not to say it didn't work as a single cam. It obviously worked very well. But I also feel like of all the shows I could think of, it's the one where the energy of the studio audience, I think, would have actually added another layer to the show. You can't tell me that every time Schmidt came on screen, there wouldn't have been a Kramer-esque ovation from the audience. True. And if there's anything I miss from multicams, It was that. I remember growing up and being like the Fonz gets an ovation. That's how I know he's cool. So I feel like Schmidt was robbed of his ovations, and for no other reason, that should have been a multicam.
Love it. Sarah D. Bunting.
My rationale for mine is very similar to yours, Tara. I'm almost never going to like something redone as a multicam, because when I say that I don't like sitcoms, what I tend to mean is that I don't like multicam sitcoms. So I'm going to say Girls, because I understand that part of the point of Girls was to force us to question our own reactions to Hannah, blah, blah, not just behavior, blah. But when something the show thinks is funny or clever doesn't land, like, is that about the show or is that about me? Like, the fact is, it's about the show. And the multicam format would have forced a certain amount of rigor in the writing as far as, like, basic joke construction and finding one character who's not tiresomely despicable. I pick Girls because I think that prestige-y sheen that you were talking about was like, just get it off of HBO and onto like ABC and make them fucking work for a living over there. Sorry, Dave.
Okay, so I'm gonna be the guy that says my answer is none, because I vastly prefer a single cam to a multicam show. Multicam shows inherently seem janky and retro to me in a way that I don't really find kitschily appealing. If you go back and make Happy Days a single cam show, would it be better? I don't know. Probably not, because we're just so used to the way it is. But today, I'd much rather watch an Arrested Development type of production rather than like a Two and a Half Men type of production. On the flip side, something that's been trying my patience, One Day at a Time, season four. The audience, they're just like into it so much, and it seems so sweetened and forced that I kind of wish they would become a single cam show.
Interesting.
Because it's really taken me, you know, in the way that when you go to, I don't know, let's say you're in high school and you're the loner, or you're part of the goth contingent, and you have to go to the pep rally, and you're just in the bleachers with your arms crossed saying, I am not participating because everybody else is having too much fun and are too loud. That's One Day at a Time right now for me. It's just like, guys, you got to dial it down. I don't believe it. So I'm going to answer by saying this question is foolishness. It's time for Around the Dial question mark. We already did Around the Dial, the Quibi stuff. So we're just using this quickly for some Patreon info and a few plugs. Tara.
All right. So Patreon, in our regular episode this week, it is recommendations for, we're calling it series starter kits, the five episodes you should start with if you are thinking of giving a new show a shot. What shows did we each pick? Which episodes do we say you should start with? Find out.
I can give you a little hint at mine.
Please. Who shall start? Dave, you want to start?
Okay. Guess what mine is, guys? It's Ancient Aliens, which means it's time, Tara, for the test. Who were they?
Aliens.
Why did they come?
Gold?
What did they leave behind?
Us.
Where did they go?
They're still here.
Will they return?
I just said they're still here.
Correct on all accounts.
I used to be able to do this with my eyes closed.
You correctly answered all the questions asked by the opening credits of Ancient Aliens.
Thank you, Dave, for that reminder. So that's on Friday. That is our topic. And we also, because if you follow me on Twitter, at Tara Ariano, T-A-R-A-A-R-I-A-N-O, you know I have been bitching about the Tiger Kingification of culture. I swear to God, I get a minimum of 5 email blasts a day because admittedly,
angry about this, well, by the way. Have at it.
Listen.
Yeah.
I get a lot of email blasts about it, including one last week that was, the subject line was, "Hey, cats and kittens," and it was from my local bra store. Like, enough is enough. Anyway, so Sarah
Yes? You sure it said kitties and not something else?
It's kittens.
I don't get it.
Yes, I am. Anyway, so Sarah came up with an idea, and we are throwing it to you. Basically, she thought you all out there in listener land should force me to watch Tiger King. And with that, also force Sarah and Dave to watch something that they will also be very resentful of watching. And we will do a special episode in which we all report back on these forcenings. What will their shows be? TBD. What do you think they will hate the most to watch? You should say. And here's how it's going to work. If we can get to 700 patrons on Patreon
by the end of April, it should be.
Okay.
The very end.
All right. We will do the special episode for you where we all let you forcing us to watch these things. Now, my forcing is already set. Clearly, it's Tiger King because I can't shut up about how much it makes me mad that you all won't shut up about it. Sarah and Dave, you get to tell them what to do. So go, if we are currently at, as I just checked, 634 patrons. If we get to 700 patrons by the end of April, we will do this for you. So go to patreon.com/extrahotgreat. to help us meet this goal, and this will happen for all of you. For my plugs, I already mentioned the Quibi post that I did, and I also did a ranking as well on Primetimer of the stunt cast Brooklyn Nine-Nine squad members' relatives and Tiny Triumph. Bradley Whitford, who, spoiler alert, plays Roger Peralta, who is on the list, I won't say where, he retweeted it in a very complimentary Yay. Way, which was cool. And the first reply was from Holland Taylor. Hello.
Oh.
Yeah, so that was awesome. Little Tiny Triumph. So we'll link to both of those in the show notes. You can check those out at Primetimer.
All right, Sarah, your plug.
I also write things on Primetimer, mostly about true crime. And when Tara says she's getting all those email blasts every day, four of them are me forwarding the thing I wrote about Tiger King on Primetimer. Just kidding.
It's not true.
That is not actually happening. I did write something on Primetimer about Tiger King. But what I'd really like to plug is the Kim Kardashian West, The Justice Project. Actually, I don't want to plug it. You shouldn't watch it. But I think as a piece of true crime, it raises some interesting questions about things. So you can check that out on Primetimer, and that will be in the show notes. That's it.
Adam, what do you got to plug?
One strange thing I do when I'm in between watching 8-minute episodes of Most Dangerous Game on Quibi is I write crime novels. And also, as you may have heard, people are trapped in their houses right now because of this global pandemic. So I have been asked to participate in a thing called Hashtag Quarantine Mystery Book Club. And if you follow me on Twitter, I'm at Sternberg. There will be more information about this. It's just coming together now. But a mystery writer, a very talented guy named Ben Winters, who wrote The Last Policeman and Underground Airlines, has organized this very much on the fly. It's a bunch of different mystery writers, most of whom are quite a bit more famous and successful than I am. And we are going to be selecting one book that people will theoretically read, and then we're going to do like a Zoom book club about it where we're going to discuss it and discuss it with the people who've read it, and in an effort to promote a book that's come out at this time, which is a really, really tough time to release a book, as you might imagine, and also to steer people towards bookshop.org, which is a website that supports independent bookstores, and if you want to order books to be mailed to your home, it's the place that you should go to do that. So there's more information about this on Twitter. I will be tweeting about it in the coming days. There'll probably be, by the time you hear this, some information about it in the world, about when it's going to happen and what the book will be. But the main thing to remember is it's hashtag Quarantine Mystery Book Club. And hopefully it'll be fun and come and talk about books with me and other smart people like Megan Abbott and Charles Yu and Joe Ide and a bunch of other great mystery writers.
Very cool.
It is time for the canon. Submitting this week is Mr. Adam Sternberg. Take it away, Adam.
Okay. I alluded earlier to my philosophy of watching these days, which is I think not so much about shows being good or bad, but whether they're for me or not for me. And my canon submission is a show that initially seemed very much not for me, but turned out to be very for me. And I think the reasons for that make it a worthwhile potential candidate for the canon. I am speaking of season one, episode one of Cheer, which is titled God Bless Texas. Now, in an alternate timeline, I think 2020 might well have been remembered as the year of cheerleading. I don't think it will be remembered that way now. But if we go back a few months to the before times, we not only had the excellent Megan Abbott show Dare Me airing on USA, which is still available for people to watch, which is a sort of cheerleading noir high school drama story, but we had the premiere back in January of the docuseries Cheer on Netflix. Now, like most things on Netflix, I didn't know anything about Cheer. I didn't even know it was coming. I didn't know much about it. And the only reason I started to watch it is because other people, like Katara's hated Tiger King, were talking about it so much online, and there was so much social media buzz that I decided to check it out and give it a chance. As I said, I'm not particularly interested in cheerleading. It's not something I know anything about. I'm not a big fan of Bring It On, for example, but I like sports documentaries, and I needed something to watch. And I should rewind a little bit here. One fond memory I have of life before the internet is when we used to sit around and do something called flipping channels, where you'd basically just sit and kind of go rhythmically through the 500-channel universe looking for something temporarily interesting or stimulating that you could watch, and often just the experience of flipping through the channels was itself sort of enjoyable. And once upon a time, I remember late at night flipping channels, and I came upon, on ESPN, a cheerleading collegiate championship event. And I was so mesmerized by it because it had this kind of weird David Lynchian vibe to it. These people doing these incredible physical feats of acrobatics while also having these creepy plastered smiles and this kind of vaguely JonBenet Ramsey sort of aesthetic. It was really intriguing, and it seemed to suggest that there was this subculture out there around competitive cheerleading that could be quite interesting. But of course, it was the 90s and there was no internet, and so I learned nothing more about it. Little did I know that subsequently, 20 years later, cheerleading has evolved into a sport that is now routinely called cheer, which brings us to the docuseries Cheer. Cheer is a little bit of a reality show. It's a little bit of a documentary. And it's a little bit, I think, a kind of affecting fable about the way that America functions right now. When I started watching it, I thought it would be something kind of like The Hills meets Bring It On, like a sort of cooked reality show about a bunch of teenagers and doing this team. But in the end, the Cheer series on a whole reminded me a lot more of another iconic 90s documentary, which was Hoop Dreams, which is all about two kids who want to become professional basketball players, but also about sort of what those sort of dreams mean to certain kinds of people in America. So on Cheer Episode 1, we start at Navarro College, which is a tiny community college in Texas that I guarantee 99% of the viewers, including me, had never heard of, but which apparently in the world of Cheer is like some combination of Manchester United meets the New York Yankees. The first clip is one of the assistant coaches who works there, who's a former cheerleader on the Cheer team. His name is Kapena Kea, talking about how he ended up going to Navarro College. And that's clip one.
And now we have so much talent from everywhere, and they want to come to this little old town in Corsicana, which I probably would have never heard of unless I've like, Navarro, okay, where is it located? Zoom it. Where? I guess I'm going there.
This is a clip they also used in a lot of the trailers for Cheer, and I think it sort of perfectly captures the initial feeling you have as you're being transported into this world. This obscure place in what feels like the middle of Texas, where these people are pursuing with a kind of like monkish devotion this pretty ridiculous pursuit, which is cheerleading. This pursuit where teenagers perform these incredible physical feats at great personal risk to themselves in high-stakes competitions that ultimately have no actual payoff for the performers themselves. There's no lucrative post-college professional cheer circuit waiting for them. They're not like college football players or even Olympic gymnasts who can look forward to sort of endorsements and like a professional career. Basically, they're all doing this incredibly dangerous, very impressive sport because it gives them, for a limited window of time, a sense of purpose in their lives. And in a very real sense, it seems for some of them to have sort of saved their lives. I chose the first episode to focus on because it's where we meet the cast of characters, and I think the cast of characters in the show is its real strength. Each one of these people, if you wrote them into a fictional show, you wouldn't believe them. They'd be totally implausible. There's no way you could write the character of Jerry, for example, and make him seem like a real person. But the cast of the show includes... there's a girl named Lexi who's a sort of platinum-headed kind of burnout, post-high school burnout, who by her own admission would be in jail if she hadn't discovered cheer or it hadn't discovered her, because somehow she also has this superhuman ability to do these insane floor routines across the mat that involve like no-handed backflips and stuff. There's a girl named Gabby Butler who is a cheerlebrity in the world of cheer. She has a million Instagram followers and two parents who are kind of crazy stage parents. There's the aforementioned Jerry, who's this impossibly ebullient, sort of cuddly African-American gay guy from out east who has come to do cheer, and he works as a base, which means he basically is the guy who throws the girls in the air and who they trust to then catch them as they come back to the ground. And then, of course, there's Ladarius, who's also a base, who describes his introduction to the world of cheer in the next clip, which is clip number two.
I was actually really, really talented at football. And the coach just always said that I was better than both of my brothers. But like me, I always said, who wants to go play football? First off, I'm tired. And second off, that is not a sport that I really want to keep playing with y'all. But I've never seen boy cheerleaders ever in my life. So I didn't even think that was even a thing until I saw the video. And it was like, oh my God, this is what cheerleading is? Like, they're really picking people up in the air. These people are really, like, flipping their bodies over like this. I've never seen stuff like this. I've never seen something that looks so fun because they look like they were having fun. And that's when I was like, okay, I'm trying out. Literally got so much hate for it. It was like, Ladarius, you're not doing it. You know how to play football. I was like, okay, I'm going to do this when I'm at practice. Did I got in trouble? I had a game because I did a round off back, two back handsprings, we got a touchdown. They took our touchdown away, actually. And I was like, okay, that was rude.
I chose that clip in part because it was very funny. And also, I remember when I was watching the first episode, that was the moment I realized that this was not just going to be a show about the people I expected it to be about. It wasn't going to be about thwarted beauty pageant contestants or overgrown cheerleaders who couldn't leave high school behind, but about these people who come from these sort of various, very different, sometimes dangerous worlds, and they've all come together in this tiny place to pursue this one thing. When I was watching the first episode, my wife was out and she came home halfway through the show and she was like, what are you watching? And rather than tell her, I just rewound to this one clip in the first episode of Ladarius where he's clapping along to a cheer in this sort of very syncopated, very stylized Vogue dance sort of way. It mimics this viral clip that had gone around the internet months before of the same guy, Ladarius. And he looks so joyful and the clip is so funny that I knew that immediately my wife would sort of understand what the appeal of the show is. And she sat down and we started the whole show from the beginning and started watching it through all the way to the end. To me, the kind of miracle of cheer as a series is that it simultaneously recognizes that cheer as an activity is vaguely ridiculous, but the show not only takes cheer seriously and takes the people who take it seriously seriously, it convinces me and you, the skeptical viewers, to take it and them seriously too. As many people joked on Twitter at the time when the show was first coming out, the experience of watching the first episode feels like going from like, where the hell is Navarro College and what is cheer? To by the end of the hour thinking, okay, if the team loses one more flyer, there is no way they are repeating at Daytona, even with Monica Aldama. Which, of course, brings us to Monica, the coach, who's the most polarizing character on the show. She's this intensely religious, very conservative taskmaster who once dreamed of working in finance in New York City. And we see these great photos of her looking like Melanie Griffith in Working Girl, dreaming of moving to New York. But instead, she stayed in the small town and became the cheer coach. She's also this fierce den mother who protects these damaged and vulnerable students and gives them this opportunity to shine and to develop this very real sense of self-worth. I think as you're watching the show, like any good complex story, people can buy into or bristle at the show's implication that cheer is a positive force in these kids' lives. Because after all, half the time these kids, especially the girls, are basically snapping their ankles or dislocating their shoulders. And more than a few of the young women clearly have pretty serious eating disorders. But what's clear is that the kids themselves believe that this is a positive force in their lives. In episode one, we see the team come together and prep for the big competition like in any good sports documentary or sports movie. The show is expertly constructed to lead up to the final competition in Daytona, but it's also compelling for reasons that become clear and are much bigger than that. What the first episode does so well is it sets up these stakes. It's not just about this 2 minutes and 15 seconds in Daytona. It's about the fact that these kids are literally willing to put their bodies on the line to do this thing they love so much. The documentary also smartly gives us the leavening presence of this historian, Natalie Adams, who wrote a book about cheerleading in American culture. And in the next clip, she talks a little bit about the toll that cheer takes on its participants. And it's followed directly by a woman named Miss Patty, who's an employee at Navarro, relating her own anecdote. So that's clip number three.
There's a constant push for it to create that kind of moment of, wow, I can't believe they just did that. And of course, many people would argue it's why there's been such an increase in injuries as well, because right now, of women's athletic activities, cheerleading accounts for the highest number of catastrophic injuries.
Sometimes when you see them flying so high, you know, I am just always praying that they have somebody to catch them because they are up there. And I have been here one time when one was flying and got hurt. And I remember exactly how it sounded when that person screamed.
I think I mentioned when I was talking about finding that cheerleading competition back flipping through the channels, it sort of reminded me there was something David Lynchian about it. And there's something David Lynchian about that Miss Patty quote, too, about the screaming girls. Mm-hmm. The reason I fell in love with cheer, and I think the first episode exemplifies all of these qualities, is that I'm not sure I've seen anything on TV recently that gets so expertly at the weirdness of current America. This strange cocktail of ambition and drive and lingering prejudices, and yet the improbable way that people still manage somehow to find their tribes against all odds again and again. What's amazing on cheer is how this team of these implausible characters from all these different kinds of backgrounds comes together and becomes this kind of metaphor. Everyone has a role, that you're a base, you're a flyer, you're a top girl, and they come together and put on this amazing spectacle that you can't believe is happening. Your jaw drops every time, and then in 2 minutes and 15 seconds, it's gone. At the beginning of this episode and over the show in general, you sort of start out, if you were me as a viewer, wondering how anyone could care so much about cheer. But at the end of it, you wonder how anyone couldn't care. The first episode is the perfect invitation into this sort of fascinating subculture and into this general sort of examination of the world we live in right now. And that is why I believe that Cheer episode one is worthy of inclusion in the canon.
Sarah, you watched it the whole season, so why don't you start us off?
I did. It was no surprise to me that this show was so appealing to me. It's by the same documentary team that made Last Chance U, which I've watched all four seasons of. And that experience, that journey that you go on in the first episode with this creative team that Adam describes, that at the beginning you're like, JUCO football in Mississippi, who cares? And then by the end you like have a fucking whiteboard and you're like, well, okay, if they lose one more, then they're not going to get to semifinals. And like, it's also really skillfully shot to give you a sense of, to give you just like a logistical physical sense of what is happening sport-wise, which for a non-coordinated viewer like myself is helpful. Mm-hmm. And I've been watching this other sports documentary series on Crackle, the Quibi of its day, about high school basketball, where it's like, these are good stories, but whoever made these episodes doesn't understand how to shoot hoops, like with a camera. Anyway, the Greg Whiteley is the producer director's name, and Cheer, I mean, having loved and seen Bring It On many times in the theater alone, I felt like I wasn't completely unfamiliar with Cheer and the stakes, but you know, rewatching this, I realized like how much more material is in this, like how many other schools they could go to. When Jerry is like obsessively watching competitions featuring like 5 to 7 year olds, yeah, in another part of the state, and his roommates are like, Jerry, really? He's like, those babies didn't have their heads in the game. And his roommates are like, oh, Jerry. That it's like, all right, but I would completely watch that. I would watch Jerry's club teams. Like there is a lot of material here. And it's also good at giving you a sense of a culture that is very different from anything that I know, but it just documents it for you and lets you think what you're going to think about it. And that so many of these kids have found a family in this little culture in Corsicana, Texas, home of the fruitcake, is really something. Like, I mean, Jerry's a star for our times, and I hope 2020 is still his year after all of this. One of my criteria is, do I want to keep watching this? And having seen the documentary the whole way through already, I rewatched this episode, and then I was finding it like not soothing, but it was like somewhere else I could go away from all of this in my mind. So I just kept watching it for like another hour and a half, and it was really a pleasure to revisit. It's a strange case for the canon. But I mean, I just think it's a really good series, and this is a good episode and an excellent, skillful intro to this world. I agree. Good presentation and good show. Tara.
What was funny to me watching this first episode is, if you'll bear with me, all of the parallels between how Cheer works and how band works. Yes, people do not have catastrophic injuries when they're in marching band. Generally, I mean, I suppose some people might fall under a sousaphone, but in terms of the, you know, the emotion and the, like, the high pitch of getting ready for a competition and like standing in a circle at the end of practice, holding hands and like psyching yourself up, like all of that happens in band, I can tell you personally. So, you know, a lot of that sort of part of it was familiar to me. But this episode, it's true, it really sucks you in. It's so well constructed. Setting the stage, the fruitcake capital is so good. And, you know, the build of it from like, here is Cheer, here is the town, here is the college, here are the kids, and introducing you to them and telling you their stories. I mean, I was all in for Ladarius as soon as we met him, and I was like, where is Jerry? Because I have heard so much about this Jerry. It really takes a while for them to introduce him, considering like what a character he becomes. So I assume there's way more Jerry content in the future episodes. But yeah, I was definitely interested to know more about him. The Gabby story of like what it means to be a Cheer celebrity, and yeah, you know, the little that we got to see her in this episode, like she doesn't seem very happy. So I assume there's more of that, because she's got a bitch face. But I also thought I appreciated that for a story that was being told about the youth of today, like there was minimal. They managed to not make it feel too, I don't know how to put this, like too bound by its time, I guess. I'm thinking of the moment where Lexi's in her room and she's talking to another cheerleader, and she's saying that everybody is on the birthday text for Shannon's birthday except for her. And it was like, that felt like the only moment where it was like, oh, it's 2020. Like, there wasn't a huge amount of, you know, social media fuckery, I guess. Like, obviously that's part of their story and part of what you deal with if you're, you know, 20 and it's 2020. And that they sort of glance at the body stuff that guys and girls go through, like the girls weighing themselves and the guys talking about like the shape that Monica wants for guys in particular roles. Like, that was interesting. And I especially loved seeing them in their Texas class for everyone who came from out of state, because what the fuck? That made me like go to Google and be like, is Navarro a Christian college? Like, is this an accredited institution? Because that was a bad class. But the final thing that note that I took was, is this concussion protocol sufficient? And then when the one trainer was like, Monica's going to be mad at me, I was like, oh, okay, good. Then therefore, I assume it is.
I took that class.
Texas class?
No, the concussion to be accredited class. For...
Concussion protocol.
Concussion protocol.
All right. Yeah. This was fascinating. Excellent choice. I can see why you got sucked in. I can see why anyone would get sucked in. So excellent presentation, Dave.
As much as you think this is like Band, Cheer is basically roller derby.
Well, there's going to be like threads that run through all of them.
Including the catastrophic injuries.
Sure.
That make you stop playing roller derby.
Absolutely.
Cough, David Teagle.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even more so because like Cheer and Derby, they kind of share that assumed inclusiveness, at least, you know, in this case, anyways. I can't speak for all Cheer, but it's certainly Derby. Derby is comprised of damaged individuals, both mentally and physically.
Sure.
I mean, that's just sort of where it started. You know what I mean? And that's kind of people that get sucked into it, usually for the better. And it seemed super familiar, like the way that people are dedicated to it, knowing that there is a finite amount of time that you can play.
Right.
You can play Derby a little bit longer and you can do Cheer, but certainly like most people just injure out. Like,
right.
That's the way it goes. It's just like you reach a certain time where you play and your body doesn't heal fast enough for you to keep playing. Certainly I would have loved if I discovered Derby 25 years ago instead of 5 years ago, you know.
Yeah.
Like I could continue playing that kind of stuff. But just like the cast of characters, where you get the people who are angry at stuff, you get the people who seem way too keen on stuff. Like, it's just such a menagerie of people.
Of like, Sport X changed my life.
Yeah.
Saved my life.
But even in the same way that it's you know, there is queer inclusivity here, much like Derby,
right.
Trans in Derby.
Yeah.
I don't know about here. So it did seem very familiar that I wasn't surprised by that feeling, by that sort of insta tribe that forms.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you get sucked into it very fast. The thing with Ladarius was amazing. Just like, he's only clapping and moving, but it seems so fucking confident and self-assured. He reminded me of Bassett from...
Oh, yeah, from Are You the One?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just how effortlessly...
Just living in his body. Yes.
He
was
just there.
Yeah.
And he wasn't thinking about it. That's just who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing what he does. And you're like... fuck, how do I tap into that? You know, and it's just like,
yeah.
The other thing that wasn't surprising was the small townedness of this whole thing, because as soon as you leave Austin, you hit all these Navarro-esque places. Like, I went up to Elgin, which is like 45 minutes away, and I might as well be in another universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I can totally see everything that's happening in this town happened there.
Yeah.
Happened to the east, to the north, to the south. It doesn't matter. Like, everywhere in Texas is like this except for some parts of some big cities.
Right.
The only surprising element of this episode that was like generally like, that seems wrong, was the townspeople of this town not knowing everything about the one thing this town is known for outside the town.
Yeah.
Like, that seemed weird to me. It's like if you met a Canadian who didn't pop in and told you who was Canadian when you mentioned them. You know, I was just watching a movie with somebody and John Candy. John Candy's Canadian, don't you know? Like, that is like, it's just a reaction you have when you are something smaller talking about, and now you live somewhere bigger, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that was the only thing. But everything else was familiar in a way, but still, it's everything sucks you in about this. It's the, you know, the characters or you know, the people and just how different they are, but they all come together to create this weird workable machine. And some of the particulars about the actual cheer process that you might not appreciate, which is, you know, there are flippers and catchers and tumblers and stunters and all this stuff. Yeah. And there's like hybrid positions and all this sort of stuff was interesting. And it's actually like, it's like derby in that way too, where you got the jammer, who's like this little small 80 pound person, ideally. And then you have, you know, the blockers who are football players, you know, that kind of stuff. So it was all very interesting. I would like to keep watching.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Official vote time. Sarah D. Bunting.
That's a yes for me.
Tara Ariano.
Yes.
And yeah, me too. So. That means Cheer, Season 1, Episode 1, God Blessed Texas. You are now in the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Sarah has the winner.
I sure do, and don't get used to hearing this show in the winter slot. Let's celebrate Southern Charm's Craig Conover, who has converted his pillow company to make scrubs and reusable masks. Well done, Craig.
Good job.
And loser?
Well, Ellen DeGeneres brought back her daytime show this week, obviously in an altered form. And in her first episode on Monday, she joked that self-isolating in her mansion is like being in jail, because everyone is gay and she's been wearing the same clothes for 10 days, as though people who are actually incarcerated are not currently being chiseled for soap they have to pay for themselves, forced to make scrubs and masks at double their pre-pandemic rate for slave labor wages, which, according to Mr. Emily Heller on Twitter, is the national average 27 cents an hour. And dying of the virus, including this week, a detainee in Cook County Jail who wasn't even convicted of anything but was locked up because he couldn't afford a $5,000 bond. So not really like being in jail, Ellen. Do you ever learn? Shut the fuck up. Get back off TV. Goodbye.
Speaking of shut the fuck up.
Do you know what time it is?
Do you know what time it is? It's
game time. All right, just to let y'all know, we're a little crunched on time, so we might blow through this a little fast. No equalizer zones today. This is the sixth game time of the season. The scores are value guess 2, Tara 1, Tara 2, Sarah 1. Today we are playing Objectionable People from Mike R., who earns himself an extra credit topic. Here are Mike's rules. Dave gives the name of a fictional lawyer from a TV show. For 2 points, name the show the character is from.
Okay.
If you need a hint, you can ask for the actor who played the character, after which the correct answer is worth 1 point. Mike is letting you guess on both parts if you so wish.
Thanks, Mike. So,
what a nice
All right.
guy.
Thanks,
45
Mike.
Questions. No show appears more than once.
Okay, wow.
The character could be any kind of lawyer, civil litigator, criminal defense attorney, prosecutor, etc.
Okay.
Etc. Steel meal situation, please, Tara.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah D. Bunting has 1 steel meal. I have 5 steel meals plus an extravaganza gong. Valued guests have 3 steel meals. So, Adam, if someone else washes out, you can say steel meal before Dave gives the answer, and then you can steal that presumably remaining 1 point because, you know, point. There's clues.
All right.
Eloquently done,
Thanks,
Tara.
Dave.
Let's throw it at Picky to see who will be going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, our order today, Sarah, Tara, Adam. Are we ready to play Objectionable People?
Yes.
Yep.
Let's do it.
All right, remember, 2 points off the bat, 1 point after the hint. Sarah D. Bunting, your lawyer, name the show, Claire Kincaid.
Law and Order Mothership.
You are correct. That's 2 points. Tara.
Yes.
Ed Danvers.
Oz.
Incorrect.
Oh.
Homicide.
Okay.
Homicide. Same actor I think you're thinking of.
Yeah.
Adam. Ben Matlock. guess the show.
Matlock.
Matlock, good for 2 points. Sarah. Matt Murdock. Murdock!
Murdock! Matt Murdock. Beverly Hills 90210?
Incorrect.
Steel Mill.
Oh, no, not yet. We're not done. She's not done Meal with steel. Her options yet. But now you know Adam knows it, so
yeah.
Probably a cheerleading show.
Yeah.
Charlie Cox is your actor.
God damn it. What is the name of that thing? It's not Iron Fist. It's the other shitty one. Blind Justice. Take it, Adam.
Steel Mill. Daredevil.
Adam gets 1 point.
Daredevil.
Tara.
Yes.
Christine Sullivan.
Oh, no. Oh, hint.
Marky Post.
Oh, duh. Night Court.
Good for one. Back to Adam. Matthew Crawley. Or Adam.
Oh, Matthew Crawley. Hint, please.
Matthew Crawley, played by Dan Stevens.
Matthew Crawley. The West Wing.
Steel Meal.
Reciprocal Steel Meal situations here. Here we go.
Downton Abbey.
Downton Abbey, good for one. Correct. Sarah D. Bunting. Probably the best entry here. Unfrozen caveman lawyer.
Saturday Night Live.
Correct. Played by Mr. Phil Hartman. Tara.
Yep.
Rhonda Perlman.
The Wire.
The Wire, correct.
Nice.
Adam. Arnold Arnie Becker.
L.A. Law.
Correct. Sarah D. Bunting. Andrea Cabot. Give me a sec. Okay. Let me
speaking
just.
Speaking of Andrea.
For Sarah D. Bunting. Look, we didn't pause because I had to enlarge the font in Excel, if that's what you're thinking, dear listener. Alexandria Cabot.
Law and Order Special Victims Unit.
You are, in fact, correct. Leland Palmer for Tara.
Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks, played by Ray Wise. Bring us into our first score break for Adam. Jerry Hogarth. Now remember, no show is in here twice, so let's go with the show that this person is most well known for. That's a little bit of a hint. Jerry Hogarth.
Can I have the hint of the actor?
Carrie Ann Moss.
It's the show with the bee from Apartment 23. And her name on the show is like May Moore, or her name is Lindy Lewis Esquire.
Incorrect.
I got a steel meal. Jessica Jones.
That's good for one. And that takes us into our first score break here after question 12.
All right. Very close game. Adam has 5 points. I have 6 points. Sarah has 7 points.
All right, back to it. Sarah D. Bunting. Howard Hamlin.
Better Call Saul.
Better Call Saul is, in fact, the correct answer. 2 points. Annalise Keating. Keating. Keating.
How to Get Away with Murder.
Murder. Murder. Correct. Barry Zuckerkorn for Adam. Barry Zuckerkorn.
Excuse me. Arrested Development.
You are correct.
Keep talking. I'm redoing my kitchen.
Sarah, Floyd DeBarber.
Dunno. Hint, please.
Jason Sudeikis.
That doesn't help me. Benson.
That is 30 Rock. Floyd from 30 Rock. This is question 17.
Spread Eagle.
Spread Eagle.
Tara.
Yes.
David Rosen.
Scandal.
Scandal, correct. Adam, Jackie Chiles.
Seinfeld.
Seinfeld, correct. This is question 19. For Sarah, Denny Crane.
Denny Crane.
Denny Crane.
Denny Crane, Denny Crane. Denny Crane. Hint.
The Shat. William Shatner.
Oh, Boston Legal.
Good for one.
He's Canadian, don't you know?
Yeah.
I do. He has my same birthday, don't you know?
Alicia Florrick, Tara.
The Good Wife. And not The Good Fight.
Adam. Lionel Hutz.
The Simpsons.
Sarah D. Bunting. Bobby Donnell. Bobby D.
What was it called? The name of the... Oh, The Practice.
I was going to say...
McDermott in The Practice. Tara.
Yeah.
Philip Banks.
The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Good for two. Bring us into our second score break. Adam. Patty Hughes. H-E-W-E-S.
Hughes. Can I get the hint of the actor, please?
Glenn Close.
Oh, yes. Ooh, the Stabby Show. Damages.
Damages is correct. A.K.A. the Stabby Show. Score, please, Sarah.
Still an extremely close game. Sarah and Adam are tied with 12 points each. I have 14.
All right. We've just gone over half, so there's plenty of game left. Let's get back to it, Sarah. John Stone. John Stone.
John Stone?
John Stone.
And there's those shows in there twice, right?
Correct.
Okay. John Stone. Hint.
John Turturro.
Oh, something with night in it. Not The Night Before. Not The Night We Met. Not About Last Night. Night Moves. Nightman! I don't know. Fuck.
It's a Nightfall.
Steel Meal. Is I too late?
No, you're good. I was joking. It's not Nightfall, the Night Crusade series. What's the answer, Adam?
The Night Of.
The Night Of.
Yay!
Tara?
Yeah.
Joseph Adama.
Battlestar Galactica.
Battlestar Galactica is... incorrect.
Oh, no!
Caprica.
Oh, well, someone could have stolen mold.
Well,
that
they didn't.
One. Okay.
Adam. Elmo Jared Franklin.
Elmo Jared Franklin. I'm going to need a clue on the actor.
Brecken Meyer.
Oh, gosh. That show he did that time. The Brecken Meyer Show.
Do you want me to read those clues for you again, Adam? Elmo really? Jared Franklin, Brecken Meyer.
Yes. Elmo Jared Franklin, Brecken Meyer.
All right, we're going to call that one on you.
Yeah, I don't know.
And let me read it again. You lost your points. Elmo Jared Franklin, Brecken Meyer. Nope, not going to get it. Franklin and Bash was the answer.
Oh, Franklin. I don't remember that show.
All right, Sarah. Alicia Phillips.
Mismatched. I don't know.
Prima Ajuman.
Yeah.
Law and Order UK.
Law and Order UK is, in fact, correct.
Hey!
Lionel Tribby, Tara.
The West Wing?
Yes. There's so much editing to do in this one. Maya Rendell for Adam.
Maya Rendell. May I have the actor, please?
Rose Leslie.
Yeah. Yes, you can have her.
Rose Leslie. That would be objection overruled.
That is The Good Fight.
Oh, yes.
To Sarah. Ron Carver.
Ron? Okay. Law and Order Criminal Intent.
Damn! I didn't know his first name either.
His name was Ron.
I think you got all the Law and Order questions.
That's pretty good.
Sebastian Stark, Tara.
Oh, no. Shit. Hint.
Everybody's favorite actor, James Woods.
Oh, shark.
Adam, Stuart Sanderson.
Stuart Sanderson. The actor, please.
The actor? Fred Savage.
The Wonder Years. The later years.
They weren't all wonderful. The Grinder.
The Grinder.
Sarah. Charles Chuck Rhodes Jr.
Jr. Hint.
Paul Giamatti.
Doesn't fucking help. I don't know. Billions? Yay.
It does help.
Tara.
Yeah.
Neil Mink.
Hint.
David Margulies.
That does not help. Psych.
Steel Mill. Do I have one left?
You have one
three,
left.
Right? I'm yep. blowing through the value guess. It's The Sopranos.
Sure is.
Nicely done.
Nice Reinwald Jonesing.
Well stolen.
Bring us into our third score break for Adam. Richard Fish.
Richard Fish. Can I get the actor's name, please?
Yes. Greg German.
Oh, it's the should have been a multicam sitcom, Ally McBeal.
Yeah.
Is it? In fact, it is. 1 point. And scores towards the end of the game, please, Tara.
You're not going to believe this, Dave. Still extremely close. Adam has 15 points. Sarah has 16 points. I have 17 points.
Oh.
Everybody's got three questions left. Starting with Sarah. Harriet Harry Korn.
Does she have a sister named Uni? I think this show is called Harry's Law.
Damn!
2 points.
Oh, man.
Sarah.
Yeah.
Harvey Specter.
Oh, Suits.
Nice.
Adam. Hyper Chicken.
Hyper Chicken. Is there an actor clue related to this?
Uh-huh.
May I have the name of the actor?
Maurice LaMarche.
Yes, LaMarche, of course. Hyper Chicken. Space Ghost.
Close. Futurama.
Oh!
Hyper Chicken, the chicken lawyer.
I would have gone Harvey Birdman.
For Sarah, Phil Ken Sebin.
Say it again, please.
Phil, as in Philip, Ken, as in Kenneth, Sebin.
With B's.
Yeah, S-E-B-B-E-N. Phil Ken Sebin.
Hint, please.
Stephen Colbert.
Saved by the Bell.
We were looking for Harvey Birdman.
God damn it, I just said Harvey Birdman too. And I was wrong for that one.
Yeah.
Harmon Harm Rab Jr.
Oh God, I know this one, but I don't know it. Hint.
David James Elliott.
Jag?
Jag. Oh.
Navely.
Navely.
Adam David Vasquez.
David Vasquez. Can I get the actor's name?
The actor is Rick Gomez.
That doesn't help me. David Vasquez, played by Rick Gomez, NYPD Blue.
Incorrect. Anybody know?
Is it The Shield?
Nope. It's Justified.
Oh yeah, right.
Now, if it were Jesse Vasquez, maybe we'd have a shot.
All right. Adam's still at 15 points. Sarah DeMunting has 18 points. I have 20.
All right. One question left. Mathematically, we still have a game here. Starting here. Last question. That? Sarah Bunting. Nina Whitley.
Game
that's
over.
This is a tough one for your last question, sir.
Hint.
Liza Koop.
Oh, God. I watched the show and I don't even remember what it's called.
Yeah.
Uh, different strokes?
Yeah, tough one. Benched.
Benched.
Oh.
A USA show.
Tara.
Yeah.
Nick George.
God, hint.
Peter Krause.
Oh, Dirty Sexy Money.
Dirty Sexy Money.
Nicely done.
And lastly, for Adam, Taylor Withersby.
Can I get the actor?
Natasha Henstridge.
Oh, some... Boston Legally Public.
Eli Stone was the answer we were looking for.
Sure. That motherfucker.
That's regulation. Scores, please, Star.
Well, we finished. All of us finished strong. Adam finished with 15. Sarah finished with 18. I had 21.
All right, let's repurpose our tiebreaker because I think you'd want to play it.
Okay.
Two steel meals at stake is a hot potato.
Hot potato.
Gonna take you back to one of our epic hot potatoes. Name as many DAs, ADAs from Law and Order Mothership as you can.
Okay.
All right, so we're gonna start with Sarah, then Tara, then Adam.
Okay.
As you cannot answer, you're out.
Okay.
Sarah.
Ben Stone.
Stone is, of course, correct. Tara?
Paul Robinette.
Paul Robinette. Correct.
Jack McCoy.
No, wait,
it's Adam's turn.
It's Adam's turn.
Oh, sorry.
I'm still in. Claire Kincaid.
Claire Kincaid. Correct.
Jack McCoy.
Adam Schiff.
I'm out.
He's out.
Oh! Sarah D. Bunting.
Arthur Branch.
Nora Lewin.
Nora Lewin.
Good old Mal Collar. Oh my God. All I can picture is the actors now. Serena Sutherland.
Insert lesbian joke here.
Yep. Shit. Oh no, how am I drawing a blank now? Oh no, the other brunette. So this is
left.
So painful. Jamie Ross!
My finger's getting so heavy.
Jamie Ross, I forgot about her. Amazing. And then there were even more.
Yeah, let me, while you're thinking, I'll tell you how many more you have to choose from.
So many.
I count five.
Okay.
Five more?
Okay. Maybe six. I can't remember if this one's been set, but yeah, five or six.
I can remember the actors, the, you know, little props that they had in their offices. I assume we can't use Jack McCoy twice.
Twice.
Okay. Correct. All right. So one of the latter day brunettes whose name is, this pains me, but I can't pull the character name of any of these. Here's one more. Mike Cutter.
Mike Cutter is correct.
Exhausted.
Pressure's on, Tara.
De La Rosa. Damn it.
You thinking of
Ruberosa?
Ruberosa?
Ruberosa.
Connie,
yes,
Ruberosa was the one you were thinking of, but that's not, you got it. All right, here's the ones you didn't get.
Good job, Sarah.
Did somebody mention Abby Carmichael?
Nope, that was the one I couldn't remember. I was just Angie Harmon, and then her character name flew out of my head.
Alex Borgia.
Right, Borgia.
Annie Paris.
And I think the only one left was the one I thought we were going to end the game on.
Yeah.
Because this person was only in one episode. This character was only in one episode.
Oh, God.
Alfred Wentworth.
Don't even remember who that is.
In the
He's
pilot.
The guy who has the commercials for J.G. Wentworth.
If you need cash now.
Way to go, Sarah.
All right, Sarah. So you got two additional steel meals for future use. Well done.
I'll take them.
Tara.
Congratulations. Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Grade. We took some nibbles at the bite-size offerings from Quibi, including Chrissy's Court, Dishmantled, Flip, Game Show, I Promise, Memory Hole, Most Dangerous Game, and Murder Flippos. We answered John C.'s question on which sitcoms should have been multicam productions before Adam successfully led the cheer for Cheers premiere into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Legal Eagle Game Time from Mike. Next up, we're creating series starter kits on Patreon on Friday. And next week here on EHG Prime, we welcome back Dan DJB Rogi to discuss the HBO series Run. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
that was rude,
Sarah D. Bunting,
home of the fruitcake,
and Adam Sternberg,
the game starts now.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra. Not great.
Five, four, three, Celine Dion!